From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
Well, you know, it's really funny. Well, when I was running in 1978 for Barbara's seat when she had decided to retire, I campaigned on the fact that I was not a Barbara Jordan, that I was different, I was my own person, and that while I realized that she made her niche in history, I wanted to make my own. I did not want to go to Congress in the shadow of Barbara Jordan. And, you know, I was not walking in her footsteps. I was not following in her shadow. I was not trying to write the same page in history that she wrote. You know, I think that that's counterproductive, as a matter of fact. It's nebulous, to say the least. But what I wanted to do was to establish my own identity. The people who went to the polls to vote for me, I think, knew the difference between Barbara Jordan and myself and voted for me because I was who I was, or I am who I am. The irony of that, though, is, or rather the contradiction in a sense, is that when I got to Congress, I felt more of the pressure to be more like Barbara Jordan than I did when I had the desire to go and when I was running for the seat, primarily because most of my colleagues expected me to be more like Barbara Jordan. She had established the seat as being one with a certain aura that that one could not deny, and you know. Generally speaking, I was pleased that I was able to succeed her.
The late Honorable George T. Mickey Leland, former U.S. Representative from the 18th Congressional District of Houston, Texas, and former chairman of the House Hunger Committee. On August 7, 1989, Texas Congressman Leland and his delegation that included eight other Americans and seven Ethiopians were in Africa on a famine relief mission to a refugee camp near the Sudanese border when their plane crashed nose first into a mountainside 30 miles away from their destination, killing all 16 aboard. Some 300 U.S. government personnel, 39 military aircraft, and a contingent of Ethiopian rescuers covered some 100,000 miles searching for the ill-fated plane. 6 days later, on August 13, 1989, a U.S. helicopter spotted the wreckage. Investigators stated that poor judgment by the pilot, coupled with bad weather, were the blame for the ill-fated crash. Today, there are a number of buildings, fellowship, government programs, and initiatives named in Leland's honor, including the Federal Building in downtown Houston, Texas. I'm John L. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, a tribute to the late George T. Mickey Leland. In Black America.
In the State House of Representatives, you're one amongst 150, and probably if you're black, as I am, you are even more outstanding in terms of your personality and your ability to relate to different people because everybody knows you. Everybody knows you all on a personal basis. In Washington and in Congress, while a lot of people know me, a lot of my colleagues know me, it's rather difficult to develop the kind of input and the kind of experience that will give you influence in the Congress as compared or as contrasted with the state legislature as one would hope or one would want in a short period of time. And so it takes a long time to really develop the kind of influence that one would want in the Congress because you're one amongst 435 people. And there's such a variety of, such a greater variety of interest in the Congress as opposed to the state legislature. State issues are pretty narrowly defined as opposed to national issues or international issues that one has to deal with as a member of Congress.
For all of George T. Mickey Leland's adult life, he epitomized the role of a public servant. He championed the causes that helped make life better for the hopeless, helpless, and homeless. It was that concern that brought him and his party of 15 to their tragic death in August of 1989. During his political career, he urged the powerful to take up the mantle with him. Leland's colleagues, friends, and alma mater have continued to carry on his legacy. Leland served six terms in the U.S. House of Representatives and 6 years in the Texas State Legislature before running for the late Barbara Jordan's 18th Congressional District seat in 1978. Born George Thomas Mickey Leland on November 27, 1944 in Lubbock, Texas, he grew up in Houston's impoverished Fifth Ward. In 1970, he graduated from Texas Southern University School of Pharmacy. Leland served as chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus in 1985 and 1986. Also, he served on the House Subcommittee on Telecommunications for 6 years. In October of 1981, In Black America traveled to Houston, Texas, to speak with the insightful politician. In the tribute to Leland, we present a rebroadcast of that conversation.
Let me just remind you, my dear brothers and sisters, however, there's one people that we have forgot to mention today, and lest I be remiss in my responsibility, I must give you who they are. There are over 2,000 Haitian people in the United States today in jail.
All right.
There are hundreds of thousand Haitian refugees in southern Florida and in New York, and some even in Houston, Texas. The United States government, when they land on these shores, rather than saying we welcome you with open arms and an open heart, they arrest them and send them back in the waters to go back to Haiti to be tortured and killed and their families intimidated.
The Honorable Mickey Leland is a member of the United States House of Representatives representing District 18, Houston, Texas. From 1972 until January 1978, Congressman Leland was a member of the Texas legislature. As a member of the Texas Congress, Mickey Leland served as a delegate to the National Democratic Convention in 1972, and in 1976, he was elected to the Democratic National Committee by the Texas State Convention. Congressman Leland is the only black in Congress from the southwestern United States. Congressman Leland, who replaced the retired Congresswoman Barbara Jordan, is a member of the Energy and Commerce Committee, the Post Office and Civil Service Committee, the District of Columbia Committee, and the Subcommittee on Census and Population. In 1978, his freshman year in Congress, Mickey Leland was elected by his freshman class to represent them in the WHIP organization for the 96th Congress. Congressman Leland was one of only two freshman members of the 96th Congress to chair a subcommittee. In 1972, the same year he was first elected to the Texas House, Mickey served as a delegate to the National Democratic Convention in Miami. In 1976, he was elected to the Democratic National Committee by the Texas State Convention. He was reelected to a second term on the Democratic National Committee in June of 1980, and also served as a delegate to the Democratic National Convention in New York. As a state representative, Mickey served on the powerful House Appropriation Committee. He was the first black ever to serve on the Conference Committee on Appropriation and the first black ever to serve on the Legislative Budget Board, considered by many to be the most powerful of all state government entities. Congressman Leland, why did you decide on politics?
Well, for a long time in my adult life, I've been committed to helping the little people of our society, particularly blacks and ethnic minorities. I know that the historical denial of them participating in this society as equal citizens has been a tremendous burden on this country in terms of its responsibility. And some of us, those of us who belong to the ethnic minority classified group of people of this country, have chosen to commit our lives to exercising responsibility or that commitment to ourselves. And so that's basically how I got involved with that commitment. I found that politics, not necessarily in the conventional sense, but being involved in the political arena is a resource for doing things to achieve a level of success for producing that equality that I alluded to and that justice. And so I use the political arena as a forum to articulate the needs and the solutions to the problems of the people who I love the most.
Who are the constituents of the 18th Congressional District here in Houston?
Well, I have a broad-based constituency in the 18th Congressional District here in Houston. We go from the very rich to the very poor. in the community. My district is about 40% black, about 30% Chicano, and the rest is white. So you see that it's also varied in terms of ethnic classification. And I tend to believe that because of my universal concept of fighting for the human rights of all people, that that I represent that cross-section of people very well, not from the standpoint that I've made such political successes that are legislative, credible measures that can be judged as being the qualitative, well, not qualitative, but rather the quantitative quantum leap made by a successful member of Congress, but rather a person who is involved and understands that the struggle for human rights for all people is one that will not be won in this lifetime that I will have, but rather I make my mark by doing the things that are necessary to establish myself for a time to come.
You replaced Barbara Jordan in Congress, in the House. Did you yourself feel any added pressures, or did other members of Congress or your constituency here in Houston put added pressures on you to be somewhat of a male Barbara Jordan?
Well, you know, it's really funny. Well, when I was running in 1978 for Barbara's seat when she had decided to retire, I campaigned on the fact that I was not a Barbara Jordan, that I was different, I was my own person, and that while I realized that she made her niche in history, I wanted to make my own. I did not want to go to Congress in the shadow of Barbara Jordan. And, you know, I was not walking in her footsteps. I was not following in her shadow. I was not trying to write the same page in history that she wrote. You know, I think that that's counterproductive, as a matter of fact. It's nebulous, to say the least. But what I wanted to do was to establish my own identity. The people who went to the polls to vote for me, I think, knew the difference between Barbara Jordan and myself and voted for me because I was who I was, or I am who I am. The irony of that, though, is, or rather the contradiction in a sense, is that when I got to Congress, I felt more of the pressure to be more like Barbara Jordan than I did when I had the desire to go and when I was running for the seat, primarily because most of my colleagues expected me to be more like Barbara Jordan. She had established the seat as being one with a certain aura that one could not deny, and you know. Generally speaking, I was pleased that I was able to succeed her. But at the same time, I felt the pressure to be more like her. And yet, soon thereafter, when I got really involved and really experienced after a few months being there, I realized that I was still Mickey Leland and that I didn't have to yield to that pressure from my colleagues to be like her. And very soon thereafter, I must say, people stopped looking at me as being the successor to Barbara Jordan, but rather as Mickey Leland, his own person and a new kind of member of Congress coming to represent the 18th Congressional District.
You were a member of the Texas House before going to Congress. Could you give us an example of the changes from writing state laws versus writing laws that is going to affect the whole country?
Well, you're very prominent in the State House of Representatives because you're one amongst 150, and probably if you're black, like as I am, you are even more outstanding in terms of your personality and your ability to relate to different people because everybody knows you on a personal basis. In Washington and in Congress, while a lot of people know me, a lot of my colleagues know me, it's rather difficult to develop the kind of input and the kind of experience that will give you influence in the Congress as compared or as contrasted with the state legislature as one would hope or one would want in a short period of time. And so it takes a long time to really develop the kind of influence that one would want in the Congress because you are one amongst 435 people. And there's such a variety of such a greater variety of interest in the Congress as opposed to the state legislature. State issues are pretty narrowly defined as opposed to national issues or international issues that one has to deal with as a member of Congress. I don't think that I feel any differently about the process itself. I have certain criticisms, of course, constructive criticisms for both. But I think that it's not a matter of like, but I think that I enjoy the privilege of being in Congress and serving in the same vein that I went to the legislature for. So in that way, it's just a different kind of experience. However, my 6 years in the state legislature gave me incredible, invaluable experience to deal in the realm of the body politic of the United States Congress.
Is there any more added pressure as being a black politician than being a white politician, or being a black congressman versus being a white congressman?
Well, I've never been a white congressman or a white politician, so it's rather difficult to compare. I would suggest to you that we have a greater responsibility, given that we're still, as black people, at the bottom rung of the ladder, and given that, we still find racism rather rampant in this country. We have to fight the burden of being responsible to take care of the interests of black people in this country. But at the same time, we also have to be credible legislators without the interest of black people necessarily, but rather the interest of the universal interest of the citizenry of this country. And even when you talk about the realm of human rights, and usually blacks are more committed to that realm universally, we have a greater burden internationally. And so it's rather difficult and frustrating. And most of us are idealistic. And you must understand, too, that in the history of this country, there have only been 50 members of the United States Congress. Today, there are only 18. So we do have a tremendous burden to try to represent the interests of the 26 to 30 million black people in this country.
Where does the power lie, on the local, state, or federal level, as far as black people are concerned, as far as getting a niche, getting some political clout?
I don't think that you can really differentiate between the levels of power in this country. I think that the real ball game for black people in this country is to be involved everywhere and to be totally involved in what it is that they're doing, whether you're in the state legislature, city council, whether you're a county commissioner, whether you're a member of Congress or otherwise. You must collectively work together to develop communications networks and that kind of thing in order that we can know what one level of government is doing to the other, for that matter, and how it is that we can commonly work together to effect some real change on behalf of our constituents.
Are you a member of any congressional committees?
Oh, sure. I'm a member of the Energy and Commerce Committee. I'm a member of the D.C. Committee. I'm a member of the Post Office and Civil Service Committee. I would suggest that the more substantive committee is probably the Energy and Commerce Committee, primarily because of the jurisdiction that it holds. I'm on the energy subcommittees, both of them. I'm also on the health subcommittee. So I have a great responsibility in those committees to try to do things to affect the change in the realm of health and in the realm of energy that will cause some support, will affect some support for our constituents, whereas historically we've not had that much support and help in those areas.
In recent weeks and months, there have been considerable controversy over the Congressional Black Caucus. Is the caucus a cohesive group of congressmen and congresswomen in fighting for injustice among minorities here in America?
There's no question about the cohesiveness of the Congressional Black Caucus. We have our differences in the realm of the caucus itself. But that's what makes us strong. We are able to meet out our differences, and we are able to challenge each other constructively with a lot of critical analyses of each other, if even sometimes to a personal level. We continue to struggle with each other, but in terms of where we are legislatively, in terms of what it is that we do on an issue basis, I think that we're probably the strongest caucus in the Congress, without question. And However, the media doesn't treat us that way. The media tends to come to the Congressional Black Caucus weekend, go to the various and sundry functions that we hold there, and they highlight the entertainment that we have, but they don't really give us the credit for being effective legislators during the time before and after the caucus weekend. They don't give us credit for doing the meticulous kinds of tedious work that's necessary in order for us to be credible legislators, all during the time that we're serving in any given session. They also don't look at the work that we do back home in our districts, the incredible casework that's probably far beyond the casework that most of our other colleagues have imposed on them. Because of the burden of being black in America, we have a greater responsibility, and I would suggest to you that the 18 members of the Congressional Black Caucus exercise their commitments by way of fulfilling that responsibility to the people we represent. But we've not gotten a fair shake in black media, in the white media otherwise. And I think it's high time that the media looked at itself and determined exactly whether or not the caucus has done, or have they rather done the caucus justice in light of the work that we know that we do. But the media is a different kind of animal. I mean, they like to challenge politicians, whoever they are, whether they're black or white or otherwise, and we just happen to be a bigger target.
How important are civil rights organizations to the upward mobility of black politicians?
Well, the civil rights organizations are very important to the upward mobility of black politicians. Black people who want to get involved in politics, because they constantly monitor, in some periods of time, less so than others for whatever reason, because most of them are struggling for survival today. But they monitor the activities of the legal authority of this country. They monitor the institutions that throw obstacles in our way to progress in the political arena, whether we're just average everyday citizens or whether we're politicians, period. And they give us a tremendous resource outside the realm of the body politic. They can do things and communicate with people. They can do things that we can't do sometimes. They reach people that we can't reach. And so they become a real invaluable resource to black politicians, and we can communicate through them about how it is that we need support for one issue or another, or even the upward mobility that you speak to.
A lot of minorities are concerned with this administration about the political and social gains that were made over the last two decades. What is your current assessment of the Reagan administration?
Well, the Reagan administration is obviously disastrous for the gains that we've made in the last 20, 30 years as a people. And I'm truly concerned that not enough people in this country who are black or who are people of goodwill who care about the ethnic minorities who have made some incremental progress in the last 20, 30 years. I'm concerned that people are asleep and people are not really aware or appraised of what's going on in this country and what Ronald Reagan is doing to reverse the process. And if, in fact, there is not strong opposition excited in this country, inspired in this country, raised to Mr. Reagan's policies, in the next few years, he's going to affect the kind of change that he wants that takes us back into the 19th century.
Do you see a return of violence that we had in the 60s? Rebellion due to unemployment, poor housing, health care?
Well, I think that people get very frustrated and depressed, and thus they react violently. It's a matter of human nature. When a person is hungry, that person either steals or kills for food, if that person can't get that. I would hope that we are more rational about how we approach the solutions or the adaptation to the alternatives to what Mr. Reagan is all about. I don't advocate violence at all, and I'm very hopeful and prayerful that we don't impose violence on ourselves or anybody else for that matter, that we move to peacefully negotiate for the kind of change. And that's why I hope that we can get organized and get rather disciplined and put ourselves in order to develop a crystal clear direction about where we're going in this country. The system itself is not going to take care of the poor and the desperate of our society. Rather, it seems that we're going to have to do it ourselves. And so we're looking for alternative means to give some hope to those folks so that they won't yield themselves to violence. I think America must be put on notice, though, that if, in fact, the Reagan administration is successful, that is a strong possibility.
Is there a difference in politics, black politics?
About 12 years ago, President Julius Nyerere of Tanzania stated, and this is a Pan-Africanist concept, if you don't mind me alluding to it, but President Nyerere of Tanzania said, we as African people must move to destroy those lines that divide African nations. And what he was saying in that was, and he was talking to all African people, whether you're in America or West Indies or whether you're in Africa proper, he was saying that we have to unify our cause. We have to deal with our common interests and our common goals. We have to pursue them as a unified force with harmony, recognizing the differences in our differences, for that matter. But he said that, to further quote him, he said, but we as African people must go farther than that. We must fight to remove those lines that divide humanity. I call that the philosophy of the benevolent oppressed. And we have witnessed here in America some of the greatest contributions made to building this country by black people who didn't help to build America for black people, but for all people. And we continue to see in the civil rights movement and in the movement today for human rights, we continue to see the strongest advocates for human rights and for universal justice, Congressional Black Caucus, legislative black caucuses, people in politics, the civil rights organizations that you talked about, continue to advocate not just for black people, but for all people. So it's not a matter of black politicians or black people fighting for black people, but they're fighting for the good of all humanity, some unknowingly, some very much knowingly.
The late Congressman George T. Mickey Leland. Leland died on August 7, 1989. He was 45. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm John L. Hanson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, One University Station, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, One University Station, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.